And this talk is a little bit different from the ones you're used to here. So I would like to go into a bit of a more general introduction than usual. Of course, I mean, you may suspect that instead of introducing the work, I'm introducing myself more or less, and maybe you would be right guessing this. We'll see. And so this the talk will be devoted to basically a project, a work that's that lies at the intersection of two point of views on condensed matter systems. So one of them has to do with the transport or dynamics of phases with macroscopic phase coherence. So it's just one of the big directions in condensed matter theory that people pursue. So macroscopic phase coherence means that underlying electrons in your system combine themselves into a bosonic macroscopic degree of freedom, and there is actually no meaningful way of describing transport in such a system. But in terms of certain quasi-particles that live in the presence of such a bosonic degree of freedom, the examples are, say, Bogoliubov quasi-particles in superconductors, or just sort of Fermi liquid type quasi-particles in ferromagnets. And then, if the system is excited in some way, the interplay between dynamics and dynamics of the quasi-particle of the incoherent part of the problem, and the dynamics of this coherent big bosonic degree of freedom, usually is quite interesting. So allow me to use this little diagram here to show up a few connections like that. So of course, one of the most famous systems of this microscopic quantum coherence is a superconductor, and there the transport is very interesting because due to Andreev processes, incoherent quasi-particles can drive condensate. That's the processes known as Andreev reflections and reflection, and they usually can be viewed as processes of somehow converting the incoherent quasi-particles into coherent condensate currents. And there is just a little reference here of my share of relevant work. And importantly, there are actually very deep connections between all these different phenomena, you know, superconductivity or ferromagnetism, or say exciton condensations in quantum Hall systems. They all can be thought of in terms of very basic, very fundamental things like this Andreev reflection, for example. For instance, Andreev reflection has the name of spin transfer torque phenomena when people consider ferromagnetic hybrid structures. Or when you go to quantum Hall bilayer exciton condensates, they can actually be viewed as a quantum Hall ferromagnets. And the way they are driven by quasi-particles is essentially very similar to spin transfer torques in ferromagnetic business. And we sort of did a little bit transport problem in such a system with Alan MacDonald. And finally, the ferromagnets themselves are very interesting, both hybrid structures with all the spin transfer torque phenomena. And I will talk today about spin orbit effect in ferromagnets. And these are all very connected phenomena. And I didn't mention BCS, sort of the exciton condensation in quantum Hall system can be essentially viewed as a BCS is a kind of an extension of BCS theory to this particle Hall system. So it really shows how unified physics is, and makes this direction interesting, I would suppose. And another part of this motivation for the talk, I guess, is the spin orbit interaction as a general title. And recently, you probably have noticed that there has been a huge flow of work based on effects of spin orbit interaction in various under various circumstances. It all essentially started with, you know, this Kane-Mellier proposal of quantum spin Hall effect in graphene, and it sort of picked up ever since. And again, here I would like sort of to outline my own interest in this area. So In this work, together with Leon Balance, we sort of consider the interplay between spin-orbit interaction and strong correlation. The predicted phase here was the topological Mott insulator, which is sort of like a spin charge separated analog of the usual topological band insulator. And that's a three-dimensional relative of the fractionalized quantum spin Hall state from work on which Sung Sik Lee is one of the authors. Another direction is to sort of taking a more realistic point of view on these systems and considering the realistic disordered surfaces in this in these systems. I come actually from mesoscopic background, so you know, transport in disordered systems is one of the things that I can do basically. And so with Dima Banin, we consider the magnetic impurities, magnetic disorder on the surface of a topological insulator, and we penned out the phase diagram for magnetic impurities on such a system. And Dima Banin is basically a recent addition to Perimeter Institute, and I mean, he's excellent. He's a great guy. He's very sharp. So I can only say that it's a great, probably the great addition to this institute. Finally, I would like to mention the work with Dima Banin that is being done right now, basically being finished. Turns out that in graphene, this effects of interaction and spin orbit together can lead to stabilization of the quantum spin phases. In the original proposal by Kane and Millay, the proposal is undermined by very, very weak spin orbit interaction in graphene. Here we show that in the presence of magnetic fields, or rather strain-induced pseudomagnetic fields, we can stabilize these phases with respect to the thermal excitations and actually make such phases observable. And in order basically to combine these two things, I will go to my next slide. And I don't know, should I really say that? When I was thinking what I should give a talk about, I mean, first my choice, of course, was to talk about spin orbit interaction and its interplay with strong correlation physics. But I figured that you get so many talks with, you know, word topological or, you know, like that in here, that maybe it would be more fun for everyone to hear something a little bit different once in a while. And so I will talk about this more, you know, hardcore condensed matter problem. Right, so what we're going to do today is to combine basically this macroscopic quantum object, ferromagnet in this case, and spin orbit interaction in it. And we will look at the transport basically properties of the ferromagnet, and we'll see that they are not trivial, both from the fundamental point of view and from the point of view of applications to, you know, real world technology. Of course, this problem of, you know, a transport in ferromagnets has had very long history, and basically the most well known example of interplay is the giant magnetoresistance in the hybrid ferromagnetic structures. This is the basis of all the solid state of all the hard drives in your computer basically right now, except they're switching to tunneling magnetic resistance too. It's known that transport can affect ferromagnetism back through so-called spin transfer torques. These kind of phenomena appear when you inject spin polarized current into a ferromagnet with polarization that is not aligned with the polarization of that current. So this, such a current can do funny things to the magnetization. And in this work, basically, I will talk about another path to connect the two, which is through the spin orbit interaction in such a system. And I designed basically this arrow to emphasize the importance of the problem. Let me now introduce the problem itself. And this graph represents the history of growth of magnetic recording density. It's the analog of Moore's law for semiconductor-based technology. So if you look at this graph, you see a couple of interesting things here. So everything starts around 1958. So before 1958, I guess it was just, you know, pieces of paper with holes punched in them. So the density is virtually zero recording density. And things picked up when IBM came up with a hard disk, first hard drive. And this rate of growth, it's a 100% compound annual growth rate, means that things get doubled every year. So there is actually a boom of technological advances here. And then all of a sudden, it stops at some point. You know, things saturate, and it stops. It starts being much slower. The 25% means it's like it gets doubled every 3 years instead of 1 year. Yeah, this is the log. This is the log scale. So things change a lot. You know, the things change by decades here. So another cusp appears here around 1980s, 1990s, where a GMR, giant magnetoresistance, was invented, and that allowed to make read heads that are much more sensitive. So it allowed to miniaturize the bits themselves. And now that we have this very, very rapid growth, and now basically it's saturating again. So the question here is what's going to be next? What's going to be next breakthrough? And one of the proposals will be spintronics, of course. But before we go to that, let me basically mention a couple of things that are important in this business. Of course, magnetic recording has to do with small ferromagnets. Essentially, information is recorded in the direction of magnetization of a small ferromagnet. Naturally, if you make ferromagnet too small, its magnetization will get randomized by thermal fluctuations. That's bad. Also, if you make a ferromagnet too small, it's actually very hard to tune magnetic fields to very small values precisely, so it will get randomized by some stray magnetic fields. Finally, if things become very small, mechanical stability can be an issue. They can just break. And here there is a schematic setup of a typical read head flying over a bunch of bits. And actually, this distance between the bits and the read head here is like a nanometer. So it's flying in the air, nanometer away from the surface, and it's not really supported. It's like supported by the flow of air. I think at Seagate there is an entire division that studies the aerodynamics of this flight of a read head above a magnetic disk. And the problem with the early hard drives was that they would stick. Actually, this read head would stick to the drive itself, so you would have to, you know, punch it really hard to make it work again. And basically, a way to get rid of these complications would be to control these bits with electric currents instead of magnetic fields. Electric currents are much easier to apply. They are much more controlled, and they've been shown to be practically relevant. Right. So let me just tell you a couple of words about this spintronics. So if you go to the present day source of wisdom, it actually does quite good. It defines spintronics as magnetoelectronics. So the word spintronics is designed to be a catchy word to sell things, but a better word would be magnetoelectronics, or basically a direction that tries to explore not only electrons charge but electron spin too in applications or in fundamental science. And I would like to quote another sort of a passage from Mikhail Dyakonov's review on spintronics. This guy is a founding father, basically, of semiconductor spintronics. He's one of the most influential guys. But if you read this, it sounds very skeptical. Let me just read it really fast, really fast. During several last years, there has been an explosive development of research in spin physics and semiconductors, research that indeed has yielded a large variety of interesting and spectacular phenomena. He appreciates that it's all very important, but again, he is the man. Since this is not sufficient for fundraising purposes, virtually every article describing this kind of research presents the following justification: this work is important for future quantum computation, of course, and as well as emerging field of spintronics. So this is actually very skeptical, and this is written in 2004. And my point, one of my sort of points here is that things has changed a lot. Things has changed a lot since this was actually said. Things are very different now. And before I go into the details of the present work, let me just mention several relevant experiments I'm just mentioning them to make sure that you understand that that's what I'm going to talk about is not this experiment. They are different. So first of all, there is a work from Japan, from Hideo Ono Group, and they managed to control the ferromagnetism with electric field, but ferromagnetism itself. You know, there is a hysteretic loop to some ferromagnet, and you can vary the size of the hysteretic loop by basically gating the system. This basically does the same, but in a different way. Here, there is a very intricate way to do this by putting some multiferroic on top of a ferromagnet. Excuse me. So you control antiferromagnetic properties of multiferroic with electric field, and this antiferromagnet actually controls the ferromagnet. So it's another way to do things. So as I said, yet another way to control actually not the ferromagnetism itself, but direction of a magnetization would be to use spin transfer torques to induce spin polarized currents into your system. And this has been demonstrated, the possibility to do this has been demonstrated quite a long time ago. Right, but the experiment that motivates this study is an experiment from actually several months ago. It's a some Spanish Barcelona-based group, but it's actually a collaboration. And what they did was a very simple thing, actually. So they considered a tri-layer. This is a layer of cobalt sandwiched between platinum and aluminum oxide. So platinum is a metal, good metal. Aluminum oxide is an insulator. So the important feature of this structure is the presence of platinum, and the fact that this Z to minus Z is symmetry is broken from the point of view of cobalt layer. I will tell you why this is important in a second. Importantly, cobalt on the thin cobalt film on platinum are known to have a strong perpendicular anisotropy. So thin means the thickness of this cobalt is actually 0.6 nanometer. And being a ferromagnet, a ferromagnetic field with strong anisotropy, it represents just a regular classical bit, up or down, you know, zero or one. And the question is whether it's possible to control this direction with the current. If it is, it's pretty good because anisotropy energy here is very strong, so it's easy to make this device small. It will be still thermally stable. And it's easy to control it if it can be controlled with an electric current. So what they observed was the following. First of all, platinum is used to pass the current through the system and measure the system too. So they first show that there is a hysteretic loop. They measure direction of magnetization by anomalous Hall effect. And they apply a magnetic field that lies in plane of the ferromagnetic field. And there is a nice hysteretic loop here. Just hysteresis is just a common property of ferromagnets that the magnetization doesn't follow the direction of the external magnetic field. There is metastability. It doesn't follow directly, so the behavior of the system depends on the history, depends on which side you approach it from. So what they did next was the following. They applied small field along a certain direction in plane here. And then they started applying current pulses along that field or opposite to it. And all of a sudden, in the entire this metastability region of this ferromagnetic field, they observed deterministic switching of magnetization direction. Deterministic shouldn't be understood as opposite to random switching. It's not like you send 100 pulses and you know 10 times it switches and 90 times it doesn't. Like every pulse basically leads to a switching from magnetization from up to down or from down to up, depending on the direction of pulse. For example, pulse along the external magnetic field takes up from up to down and does nothing to down, and pulse in the opposite direction does the reverse. It takes up, it takes down to up, and does nothing to up. And basically, the magnetization perpendicular. That's the property of cobalt on 111 phase of platinum. It's just known to be Say it again. Pulse is a current pulse. So magnetic there is a tiny magnetic field applied in plane, and they just shoot a current along the field or opposite to the field. And the thing is that if you shoot current perpendicular to the field, nothing happens. It's another sort of manifestation of importance of Rajba here. That's right. Yes, it's just if it's perfectly vertical, there is no switching. I'll talk about that a little bit. So basically, the purpose of this work is to describe the theory for this experiment, and then see that things work out quite nicely. All right. So in order to quantify this phenomenon, they did a couple of things. First of all, it's intuitively clear that if current switches from up to down or from down to up, external magnetic field applied in the vertical direction should either help that switching or oppose that switching. Right? Current magnetic field that points downwards should help current to switch magnetization from up to down. And that's what they observe. They observe that, you know, depending on the current pulse, a magnetic field either helps switching, it helps switching, it decreases current which is needed for switching, or it opposes switching. And by the slope of this line, they can actually, and these guys are just mirror twins of each other, so it really doesn't depend on the direction. Same thing happens here, and it allows to estimate the intensity of this effective field coming from spin orbit interaction. I will talk more about what that is, to be some 70, 80 millitesla per 10 to the 8th of amp per centimeter squared. That's how strong basically the effect is, essentially. Another quantity that's of interest is a critical current, the critical current at which we actually get switching. Of course, if current is very small, nothing will happen. Current has to be strong enough to achieve the switching. And this quantity, the critical current, depends on the duration of the pulse. Of course, if pulse is very short, you need to apply a lot of current to do something. But rather, if the pulse is long enough, see, the current pretty much saturates at certain value that is a value appropriate for, you know, stationary essentially switching. So these two we will use to benchmark obtained results. I should mention several works which are relevant because, you know, nothing happens in vacuum. There is a relevant experiment on spin polarization semiconductors, and importantly, there is a recent work on the same kind of system, which showed that both Rajba effect and spin hole effect in platinum can lead to very similar phenomena. But in this system, the Rajba basically is very weak, but in the systems of Miron et al., it's much stronger. And theory for a semiconductor for closely related phenomena was worked out by Bert Halpern and collaborators. Actually, yeah, Bert Halpern is hidden in this et al., which I shouldn't probably do. But these works are big influence for us. So what is important? What are important bits of physics here? Of course, the two basic ingredients, I essentially mentioned them, is a structural inversion asymmetry, the fact that cobalt sees different things up and down. This is the usual setup for obtaining Rajba spin orbit interaction in condensed matter systems. And of course, another part of the problem is ferromagnetism itself, ferromagnetism of cobalt. And this is the interplay of the two that we will have to take into account here. Let me just take these pieces and describe them, you know, step by step. So spin orbit interaction, as is well known, is the first non-relativistic correction, relativistic correction to non-relativistic Schrödinger equation. Usually, it's considered very small in condensed matter systems, but when you get to elements from the bottom of the periodic table. And platinum is just one of these elements. Its atomic number is 78. the spin orbit can get pretty large because it scales as z to the fourth atomic number to the fourth power. So this spin orbit Hamiltonian looks like an effective magnetic field that is seen by the spin of the electron, and it depends on the electric field in which electron moves and the momentum with which electron moves, right? So for free like electrons, we can just substitute this del operator with p, and if there is a electric field from inversion symmetry breaking in the system, it will lead to the usual Rushbaugh-Hamiltonian. You may have seen this Rushbaugh-Hamiltonian in all this works on topological insulators or electrons in quantum wells. It's all basically the same Hamiltonian. I should probably mention that this should not be the case for tightly bound d electrons in cobalt. Cobalt is a 3D material with relevant 3D orbitals. Yeah, instead of using this Hamiltonian, you should have specified the spin splitting in the entire brilliant zone. But we will see that actually for the present case, we can get away with such a simple Hamiltonian here. So why is this an interesting Hamiltonian?
Does the magnitude of alpha r have anything to do with the strength of spin orbit interactions in platinum, or
I think it has everything to do with platinum dominates spin orbit interaction here. Okay. Let me just go one slide forward, and I will talk about that. I just need to mention that there are s and d electrons, but the platinum. First of all, the entire anisotropy energy in cobalt platinum multilayers comes from strong platinum substrate, and it's known actually that when you look at Rushbaugh at surfaces of other metals, say like silver, you will not see anything before you take like bismuth next to it. You really need a heavy element next to your surface in order to make this Rushbaugh strong, and bismuth is right next to platinum in periodic table. It's also a very strong spin orbit couple thing, and platinum is very important, yes, in this sense.
Wouldn't you apply a gate?
In principle, maybe you can apply huge electric fields, but see, if you apply huge electric fields, you will, first of all, it's hard to do, and they want to get something that works in real life. Second of all, you can just break the sample. So it's just in principle, yeah. But about usefulness of this Hamiltonian, you see this p momentum, electronic momentum here, and what happens when the electric current is applied to the system is that electrons go with some average drift value of momentum, proportional to electric field to scattering time, and if you substitute this drift momentum, which is essentially proportional to the current density, this looks like an effect, like a magnetic field seen by electrons that depends on the transport current, which means that you can control the behavior of electronic spin with the perfectly usual normal current that flows in the real space. Spin orbit is, and this spin orbit in particular, is a link between orbital spaces in which currents are flowing and the spin spaces in which magnetizations or spin or whatever you're dealing with live. Right, so now I will switch to the ferromagnetic part of the problem. And if you look at the band structure of cobalt, it looks like this, which looks like something you do not really want to deal with for obvious reasons. So if you zoom out a bit, things start to look like this basically. A little bit simpler. So cobalt is a 3D element, as I said. So the relevant atomic orbitals are 3D and 4s orbitals. 3D orbitals are very much localized orbitals that are essentially responsible for magnetism in cobalt. And s electrons are these transport electrons that flying on top of these d electrons, seeing exchange interaction with them. And usually, in cobalt, actually, there is a minority Fermi surface for cobalt, which will be important in what follows. The spin splitting of the s electrons, how much they are shifted by exchange, is not so large in these materials. So the system is a little bit messy because there are dozen of relevant bands. There are all these s d electrons. But it's actually very well known that very simple mean field theories work very well for ferromagnets. For example, this giant magnetoresistance, which essentially sensitivity of transport through the through a ferromagnet, sensitivity to its magnetization orientation, can be explained in very simple terms in so-called two current model, in which up and down spins conduct electricity independently with different conductivities. So despite all these complications, we can actually simplify the problem quite a bit just by borrowing intuition from older studies of GMR in particular. So as I said, in principle, all electrons are responsible for both transport and magnetizing the system. But S electrons are preferred, their mobilities are much higher. So transport is carried by S electrons here in these systems. And also, these S electrons being sort of living in this spread out S orbitals, they actually hybridize with platinum much more efficiently than the D electrons. So they feel a lot more sort of spin orbit interaction than the D electrons. So basically, transport.
Is this a unique feature of cobalt that you have both S and D bands at the
Of course not. Any 3D transition metal will have.
It's the same for all of them.
Yeah, but except I think in iron you actually don't have a minority Fermi surface. You have the minority band is below the Fermi surface, if I remember correctly. Nickel is much the same as cobalt in this sense. Cobalt is a very typical 3D transition metal ferromagnet. As I said, S electrons are the electrons responsible for transport. They are actually electrons strongly spin orbit coupled, I will show you basically that the spin dependence of transport is very important here, and there are two possible sources of spin dependence in transport in this context. For example, these minority S electrons, they will scatter very strongly into empty minority Fermi surface states of D bands. That means their lifetime will be, transport lifetime will be much shorter than majority, than that of majority electrons. These majority electrons actually carry most of the current. Majority and minority refers to electron magnetic moment pointing along magnetization or opposite to it. So it's energetically preferable to point along magnetization. So there are more such electrons, and they are called majority. Minority is the opposite of that. So as I said, there are two possible sources of spin-dependent transport in this system. One would come from the scattering between S electrons and D electrons mostly. Another source would come from spin splitting of the band, from moving minority electrons up in energies. That makes density of states different at two Fermi surfaces, and that makes scattering times different at the two Fermi surfaces. So it's kind of messy to describe the two effects together. So I will basically do two models. One model I will call itinerant transitional metal ferromagnet, in which this spin dependence comes from spin dependent scattering, and another model is magnetic semiconductor model, in which spin dependence of transport comes from purely band structure effects. And we will compare the results. In principle, in both models, we can have switching behavior due to external currents. Right, so these are essentially two models. So the property of this itinerant transition metal model will be spin-dependent impurity scattering, basically. It's impossible to have a In the presence of strong exchange, it's impossible to have impurity scattering that's independent of spin. Also, minority electrons scatter into D states, and that limits their lifetime by a lot. And we will neglect the spin splitting, the motion of bands because of the exchange energy in this model. Instead, in a magnetic semiconductor, suppose you have some gallium arsenide doped with magnetic impurities, and they will form some sort of a magnetic semiconductor. They are known to exist. These impurity states, there is no band associated with those states. They're basically an impurity, a very narrow impurity band here. And these impurities split the band structure of the conducting electrons. So in this case, the spin dependence of transport can come only from this band structure effect, from the spin splitting of the band structure. And the idea of the calculation that will be performed is very similar in both cases. The Hamiltonian for this conduction electrons look like this, fairly common Hamiltonian. We have band energy for spin orbit uncoupled and exchange uncoupled band structure. We have some momentum dependent magnetic field in which electrons move, and we have a disorder potential. The difference between the two models essentially comes in this disorder potential. So the p-dependent magnetic field here will have an exchange contribution. Delta exchange is essentially an energy scale associated with the coupling between this magnetization and conducting electrons. And it also has this spin orbit piece in it that has the usual Rajba form. Oh yeah, this exactly. Thanks. This is huge. The exchange interaction is electron volt, like a fraction of electron volt essentially here. Alpha is usually much smaller. It's like at most 0.1, but usually smaller than that. Right. So then the scattering of impurities is described by the usual impurity Hamiltonian. So this V of R minus Ri is a spatial profile of impurity potential, and U plus and U minus measure the scattering amplitudes for majority and minority electrons. So since I should say that because electronic charge is negative, it means that majority electrons have their spins opposite to the magnetization. So their magnetic moments are along magnetization, but spin moments are opposite to it. So this U plus is the minority electron. It means that its real spin points along magnetization will be larger than U minus because their lifetime is shorter. This is one model of impurity. We can consider a different model in which we have two sets of impurities that scatter only up electrons or only down electrons. This is more like scattering in those d electron minority Fermi surface. But the kinetic equation that results from these two models are essentially the same upon relabeling of certain scattering times. So it basically suffices to use only one model, because by making these use equal to each other, we can go between this itinerant ferromagnet and some magnetic semiconductor models. Then finally, the effective field. I should say that what happens here is that magnetization, the d electrons polarize the s electrons in the presence of transport magnetic transport current. There is some magnetization of s electrons, of transport electrons, and this magnetization exerts torque on the ferromagnet's magnetization, and this way it can rotate it and control it. And it's found by this from this usual expression from variational. It's a effective field is a variational derivative of the Hamiltonian with respect to magnetization, and it's essentially proportional to the average spin polarization of transport electrons. The operator for this is written here. In order to find this average, we just need to find the stationary state of transport electrons, and for that you need to solve quantum kinetic equation for this particular model. I will mention that the self-energy is like, you know what self-energy is, right? It's like an effective potential that enters electronic Green's function. For this particular case, is proportional to, of course, the number of electrons, and there are a couple of impurity vortices here, which are not one as in the usual problem. They are given by this expression from the scattering potential. And these check marks on top of quantities means that these are actually matrices in Kelder space. But I will not go into that because, you know, if you know, you know. If you don't know what Kelder's technique is, there is no chance I can explain this in limited time. So before I go into any detail, let's see what kind of terms are actually allowed by symmetry in this particular system. So let me set up the coordinate system like this. So x, y, z axis, all as usual. I have a electric field along x axis, and magnetization points in x, y, z. As we sort of mentioned, the magnetization is tilted a little bit away from the vertical direction by an external small magnetic field. So just by considering the properties with respect to reflections in this xz plane and yz plane, we can figure out what spin polarization of transport electrons are possible in this system. And it's actually very easy to do. For example, let's take the first line, so xz plane. And both mx and mz are m is a pseudo vector, it's like a magnetic field. So when I reflect the system in this plane, z and x component must flip the sign. And that's what's just written here. Electric field doesn't do anything, nothing happens to electric field if I flip the system in this plane. So it's positive under that transformation. And the components of spin polarization have the properties of a pseudo vector. Z component and an x component flip sign, and the y component remains invariant. And just by analyzing products of these pluses and minuses, we will see that only the following combinations are possible. So and of course, I'm talking about non-equilibrium polarizations here, so they're proportional to the electric field. They're linear response polarizations. So the X polarization should be proportional to MZ, and Y polarization should not depend on MZ or MX at all, or it can depend on some even function of MZ and MX, like MX squared plus MZ squared, say. And SZ should be proportional to MX. And then just by using this expression for the
but the current is already spin polarized, so this is in addition to equilibrium.
Not really. Sorry. No, there is only one ferromagnet. So current that is induced in the system is unpolarized. What happens is that it creates a local magnetization of transport electrons, basically. It's not like in hybrid structures where you have, you know, ferromagnets with crossed polarization, and you inject current from this ferromagnet, and it exerts torque on this magnetization. It's different. Here you do not need the second ferromagnet. You inject unpolarized current, and it does the job.
Oh, I see. So if you inject, so even though the density
I see now what you're asking. Okay. So basically here there will be polarization of the current, of course, just because in the real ferromagnet you will have spin split band structure. But an important point is that this spin splitting is small, so it's not necessary to take into account. Important point is that if it's polarized in the direction of magnetization, so it will not exert any torque on it. So if such a polarization will not lead to switching, pretty much. Yeah. We need something fancier than just this, you know, polarization because it's a ferromagnet. Okay. So there are two possibilities here. One possibility is that this polarization points along the magnetization, but has a non-trivial coefficient. The polarization that you're talking about wouldn't have this mx, mz in front of it. It would be just m with some coefficient, which is independent of the current, say, direction or, you know, that kind of stuff. So if such a parallel magnetization appears, it it looks to like an effective Zeeman field, basically, that tries to adjust the sign of MZ properly. So this way, such a field actually can lead to switching. Another possibility, just if you look at this carefully, you know, this SX is proportional to MZ, so SZ is proportional to MX, is just a cross product between EY and M. And such a field will just exert a torque. It will try to rotate magnetization, and such a field can also lead to switching in the problem. Of course, this symmetry analysis doesn't tell you anything about the coefficients in front of these expressions. They may well be zero, and then you will get nothing. However, we will show, of course, I mean, otherwise I wouldn't be talking about this, that coefficients are not zero. And these are leading terms in spin orbit in the two models that I described. All right, so before I give you more detail, let me try to give you a physical picture of what's going on in this system. So why is spin-dependent transport important? So let's forget about spin-orbit interaction altogether. We have just majority electrons. They behave as two subsystems of electrons, say, up and down in the magnetization with respect to local magnetization. If you apply electric field to such a system, because of the scattering times are different from the majority and minority electrons, they will respond to electric field in a different way. Of course, the larger the scattering time, the larger the response will be. It's sort of kind of intuitive, right? If responses are different, and this is just the common shift of a distribution function by the electric field. It's very easy to obtain it from the usual kinetic equation. Such a spin dependent response to electric field will create magnetization in the P space, in the momentum space. It is directed along the local magnetization, but it has a cosine profile along the Fermi surface. By itself, such a magnetization doesn't do anything. When you average over the Fermi surface, this cosine will average to zero. So it cannot lead to anything interesting by itself. However, if you include spin-orbit interaction, essentially, in this form and write it out in components, you will see that the y component of this spin-orbit interaction has just the same cosine phi dependence in it. So this component of the spin orbit is in phase with this magnetization produced by the electric field. And this y component of the Rushbaugh field will be more or less rotate all electrons with, how to say this, in phase and create non-zero perpendicular polarization in the presence of the current. And it is this polarization that will actually lead to switching. And what I just said can be illustrated using a cartoon. Suppose this is a Fermi surface. So this delta M points in the opposite direction at phi equal to zero and pi, like this and like this. And magnetic field here also sort of rotates together with the spin polarization. And the cross product between these two vectors, are the same. They point in the same direction, means that this spin orbit field sort of rotates spin in the same direction all over the around the entire entire Fermi surface. All right, so let me actually give you the results at this point. So we see that in the case of a magnetic semiconductor, we have several components to the effective field. One is the usual Rushbaugh effective field that points along the y direction. This is the Rushbaugh transport field I mentioned a few slides ago. It's known that it exists. And there is another field that points in the m direction with this coefficient that was advertised. Of course, there is a little bit more dependence on m here, but these are all even functions, so they do not change the symmetry properties of this term. And importantly, this term, the switching field, it knows about the direction of mz. So it prefers one sign of mz compared to the other side of mz. And this mx can be thought of just, as you said, Anton, tilting by tilting by that external magnetic field a little bit. So this mx essentially is pinned by a magnetic field. The entire expression is proportional to this coefficient gamma naught, which is given here. This is called non-probabilicity parameter. This is the quantity that was first sort of introduced in that work by Hans Andreas Engel and Bert Halperin and Rasbach himself. It basically tells us how different from parabolic the spectrum is. Because in 2D, and this magnetic semiconductor case, basically, I use just 2D, the usual 2D case, 2DAG case. In 2D, if you have a parabolic spectrum, the density of states doesn't depend on energy. That means that if you split bands, you move them up and down like this, the scattering times will not be different. Means for p squared over 2m, there is simply no effect in this case. So you need this band non-parabolicity to have the switching action of the transport current. So this is essentially the field that leads to switching. This is the expression just for reference for the current as a function of electric field. And in principle, it's a nice result. This expression is similar to the one, is the same as the one obtained in literature. I quote only one paper here because it's specifically devoted by ferromagnets, but there are many others that consider this term in the semiconductors. But this term actually cannot be obtained in the way these guys do things because there is no way to introduce this band non-parabolicity. The kinetic equation that they solve do not allow this.
It's magnetic field, effective magnetic field perpendicular to the current.
That's right, yes.
It's in plane.
Actually, maybe I just, I'm not sure of what it's called. It's usually called Rashba field.
No, I mean that.
It comes from here, just from assigning drift value to the
right,
P
so
here.
If you pass a current, you get perpendicular to the
you
current.
Get this field, which is perpendicular to normal to the plane and to the current. So. Yeah, that's just this field.
And the switching field, so is it
switching field,
opposite to the magnetization?
So in this case, switching field direction depends on the sign of mz. So if gamma naught is negative, this is parameter that is essentially unknown. And this is not the case of cobalt. I just do it for reference. It's a model. You know, if they do an experiment on magnetic semiconductor, this should be the theory for that phenomenon. But here, if gamma is negative, then the majority time will be longer than minority time, just the same way in the cobalt. If gamma is negative, the whole thing is positive. So the field tries to make mz negative to lower the energy, basically. So it knows whether m points in this direction or in this direction and tries to revert it. And in this case, it's likely that the reversal will happen through domain nucleation because it sort of pushes magnetization along its own direction. So in order to illustrate the other case, I should go to this itinerant ferromagnet case, and the expressions here are a little bit longer, but again, you see this the structure. This the analog of gamma naught in this case is the difference between majority and minority times, and also this field is not simply EY. It's actually this combination. So if you look at the torque of this field, so you have to take a cross product between this and M. The torque will look just like a torque from the field in EY direction. However, this field doesn't produce Zeeman energy. If you dot it into M, it's perpendicular to M. It's going to be zero. So this is a weird field that exerts torque but doesn't give any Zeeman energy. But it's of course completely normal because these fields are not real magnetic field. They're effective magnetic field that come from electric fields. So the switching, the real switching field in this case is actually EY cross M, the other case I illustrated in that symmetry example. And it is actually, I should mention that these terms are leading terms in alpha for these two cases. If you go to alpha cube, here you will get a field along magnetization. And in this case, if you go to alpha cube, you will get a field perpendicular to magnetization. The difference comes from the fact that in the semiconductor case, the spin flip times are determined by alpha too. So and since all these taus start to depend on alpha, the order of things sort of changes a little bit. But it's really a technical thing, and to write down next order expressions is actually quite cumbersome. What I want to sort of emphasize here is that the effective switching field is smaller than the Rushbrook field by this factor. This is the product of the exchange splitting and the relaxation time for the perpendicular component of the magnetization. And the expression for the current is just this, and you see that majority and minority electrons just carry current in parallel. The current is given by the sum of the conductivities for the two spin fluids. And since this is the case relevant to the experiment, I would like to sort of to show you what it actually does. And in order to compare it to experiment, I should mention that the value of this field, the authors of the experiment measure in a different way from a different experiment. And the intensity of this field is given by like 1 tesla per 10 to the 8th of m per centimeter squared. So this is basically known. So if we somehow figure out this additional coefficient, that is the ratio of the two fields, we can actually compare the results of the theory to experiment. So the way I would like to do this is to consider this critical current. And in particular, I would like to consider this saturation part of this dependence, because here you really need to have some sort of a model for switching, and you cannot really address this rise here, right? In order to find the switching current, we basically assume that magnetization, that cobalt behaves as a macro spin. So it will write down the Landau-Lifshitz equations which govern the magnetization dynamics in the system, and put this alpha, the Gilbert damping parameter, to be very large to make sure that magnetization just, if it points up at some point when this switching field grows, this up direction will become unstable, and this large alpha just makes sure that it goes right to the stable solution at that point. So in order to reproduce this switching current around 1 milliamp, and in order to go between current densities and currents, I just need to multiply it by system cross-section area. We get the intensity of the switching field around 150, 250 millitesla per the same current density as here. I told you that the reported values are actually somewhat smaller, 2-3 times smaller, but they actually are reported as a measurements of BZ. They apply a field in the perpendicular direction rather than in that direction in which that effective magnetic field acts. So I cannot really disclose these things, but they're doing doing new experiments in which they apply this external field in a carefully chosen direction, so to speak, and it actually brings up these numbers to essentially this range, which is nice and at least suggests that we're doing something right here. Yes.
Landau's equation, H effective contains all the Rochebach term and the currents.
So I never actually mentioned what these fields are. So there are several effective magnetic fields that contribute to the dynamics. Yeah, thanks for asking. So there is a magnetic field that comes from anisotropy, perpendicular anisotropy in the film. There is a magnetic field that comes from the just applied external magnetic field, which is important to tilt that magnetization, as I said. And finally, there are torques that come from this non-equilibrium effective magnetic field that come from Rushbrook. And this term is just a damping term. So this term rotates magnetization sort of like this perpendicular to itself, and this term makes it relax like in this direction to some stable direction. Right, and as I said, the numbers that come out of this actually turns out to be pretty close. It's actually surprisingly close to what they see right now, given the somewhat phenomenological level of consideration here. Right, in how much time do I have left? Because we started a little bit later. Late. Oh, great. Yeah, that's what I need. So far I gave you sort of the general motivation, the physical picture of the phenomenon and the results. And right now I would like to spend these last 10 minutes to describe what is actually done to solve this problem. So I hope that everybody knows what Boltzmann kinetic equation is. At least maybe you've heard about it. This is the kinetic equation. This is the equation for the distribution function of particles, electrons in this case, that governs their dynamics in the presence of external fields and relaxation, basically. This is the usual form. It's got some time derivative, drift term, a drive term. This is electric field that drives electrons, and everything is relaxed by the collision integral. So this is the case for the completely two independent spins. One does not care about the spin as a quantum number. So one may ask how to generalize this to a problem with a spin. Of course, if spin is taken to be a quantum degree of freedom, you need to promote the distribution function to a density matrix, to a 2x2 object that contains coherences in it. All right. So of course, one can add precession terms to the kinetic equation, and because now F is a matrix, so we can form commutators and anti-commutators with this matrix, and usually commutators rotate magnetization, and anti-commutators basically drive quasiparticles, there is the last point here is write the collision integral carefully, and of course carefully is the key word here. Because normally what people do, they just do these steps. They add this commutator, some drive term, and they use some sort of relaxation time approximation for the collision integral. And in this kind of problem, that turns out to be actually wrong. It leads to incorrect results, and there are quite a few of those. And still, actually, people publish things that are wrong because of this collision integral. And the reason that this is wrong, let's not look here, given the number of minutes that are left. Let me just tell you what happens. Basically, collision integral in this case becomes a generation term. So what does it mean? Generation term for the magnetization. Suppose I have a unpolarized current of electrons flowing past a certain impurity, right? So unpolarized electron means it's one half probability up, one half probability down. And I scatter this electron off some impurity. Now, if the scattering rate is spin dependent, it will create magnetization in P space. Because, I had 50% up, 50% down. Now, so suppose down scatters with rate twice as big as up. I will create magnetization. I will magnetize this unpolarized current. And that's what this collision integral essentially does. Of course, if you have a magnetic field, effect magnetic field that depends on P, situation is a little bit more complicated than what I said, just two different rates. But essentially, this is it. And you can just use Fermi-Golden rule to get this magnetization generation rate. And,
is this a small effect? Like
right, exactly. So this effect is of order of alpha or whatever field I magnetic field applied divided by Fermi energy, but it's important. Basically, if you wanna get those Rushba fields, you need to write down kinetic equation to order alpha divided by Fermi energy. So you need to keep those terms consistently. If you keep them in the spin splitting in the generation term, if you take this f to be spin, not just delta function, not theta function of epsilon minus mu, but actually spin split distribution function, and you take this displaying finite to be here, you need to do the same in the collision integral. So in the present case, I neglected the spin splitting for itinerant ferromagnet case, for metallic case, because there is already enough spin dependent scattering without that spin splitting. We do not need to consider first order and alpha over Fermi in that case. But for a semiconductor, you need to consider the spin splittings, and you need to do it consistently. And that's the source of mistakes basically in the literature. Right. And if there is one thing to remember about this kinetic equation, is that it's actually it describes quite a clear physical picture. Is that when electrons are accelerated by an electric field, the magnetic field that they see becomes time dependent. It depends on momentum, so it starts to depend on time. When spin sees a time dependent field, it cannot adjust to it adiabatically. It cannot just go around the field following the direction. There will be some non adiabatic component, perpendicular component of that field. So that's the generation terms. And then when each time this electron sort of hits an impurity, it sort of relaxes this component and also relaxes relaxes the component and relaxes its momentum, and that's the effect of disorder in this system. And the lesson is that for a general band structure, these two do not cancel. You have overall magnetization generation in this system. And just if you wonder what it looks like, this is the collision integral for the semiconductor piece. Epsilon nu of p are just the full energy in the presence of this field. This is the energy that is conserved in the collision. This is the energy of the asymptotic states. That's why we have this energy conserving delta functions. And these projectors onto eigenstate p is a projector onto plus minus direction of bp. Essentially, tells you that these are good starting and final states in the scattering process. And this is quite a technical detail. I put this couple of slides, maybe if somebody will be interested in the technical details of the work, but you really don't have to really to follow this. This I just want to mention that the collision integral has two pieces in it. The usual collision integral, just some relaxation time that leads to Jakunov-Pirelli relaxation of spin, and then the first alpha over E Fermi correction becomes the generation term important in the semiconductor case. And this is the final form of the kinetic equation that needs to be solved. And here is the density of states, p is momentum, and there are not many more other notations. And this is just the solution of the kinetic equation, and the results have not changed over the past several slides, so they are still the same, still pretty good, I think. And with that, let me actually go to the conclusions. Here I will take conclusion here. I will keep them brief. Spin orbit interaction seems to be important, and it does lead to a very sort of non-trivial transport properties in ferromagnetic systems, and lead to possibility of electric control of their ferromagnetic properties. Then, in terms of sort of future work, I should mention that the symmetry-wise, the thermal gradients are the same as electric fields, and there are now experimental works on spin Seebeck effect in very similar systems. So these equations can be applied there too. And if I am asked, what needs to be done in this area, I would say that this spin orbit interaction is still a hot topic, and it's interplay with Coulomb interaction, with interaction physics in various systems, or correlation physics is very important. I mentioned the examples of interplay of spin orbit with Coulomb interaction. Here it's a interplay of spin orbit with essentially exchange correlations, ferromagnetic correlations. And this is a hot and interesting topic. And another thing is that spin orbit actually leads to new superconducting phases. And the kinetics of this superconductive phases can also be interesting. So in those non-trivial superconductors, unconventional superconductors, there are things that are essentially Andreev-bound state at the surface. Some people call them Majorana fermions, dispersive Majorana fermions, but those are just Andreev-bound states. And just say considering thermal transport of these Majorana fermions, because they are neutrals themselves, can be a very interesting problem, because basically there is not much real-world predictions about the Majorana fermions besides that they should exist somewhere. And just to conclude the talk, I just want to emphasize that condensed matter theory is actually a very rich subject, and there are lots of problems, and all of them are interesting, and not all of them have a word topology in them, but they're still pretty cool, and it's a very nice area to be in, actually. So yeah, thank you very much for your attention.
Back in, I mean, can you do the same calculation for a magnetized surface of topological insulator?
I intend actually to do this, except there things are a little bit tricky. So here it was important to have this in-play magnetic field, right, to tilt the magnetization. The surface state of a topological insulator wouldn't respond to an in-plane field, because it just shift the cone. So you need to do things, you know, sort of fancier than that. But I am thinking about just this problem. Say it again.
Maybe slightly time dependent field.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. You need to couple this boundary to something essentially to do this. Yeah.
So this is related to this bound states issue. Now, in the system that you are considering. Suppose there is magnetization, switching, and there is a domain wall.
Uh-huh.
And in your formalism, you talk in terms of background fermions plus magnetization.
That's right, yes.
So will there be some new physics at the domain wall, new topology?
I don't think it will have a word topology literally in it, but that really depends on the magnetic domain. Actually, I should mention this. So these guys considered both monodomain and multi-domain samples, and they actually showed that having multiple domains doesn't do anything. They just switch. They just switch independently.
So that's at the level of magnetization dynamics.
That's right.
But
yes.
What I'm asking is at the level of quasi-particles, because their character will get modified when you go to the domain wall boundary.
I mean, of course. I mean,
superfluid helium 3, you have very complicated domain walls and so on. And there are many non-trivial bound state excitations.
So generally, sorry, I interrupted you.
There should be similar thing, because your formalism involves fermionic quasi-particles also. It's not like Hertzberg-Landau theory where you have only.
You're right. Right, absolutely. So what varying in space magnetization does, its gradient basically becomes a spin flipper, it means it connecting. So if you have magnetization, say, that is constant in space, you will have up and down basically propagating independently in it. Once you introduce a magnetization gradient, if you go to the local frame to this couple this magnetization, it will be a spin flipper. And this needs to be taken into account.
But then that could induce bound states. In fact, that's what happens.
It does two things. It introduces sort of this fake gauge fields into the quasi-particle Hamiltonian if you disregard spin flipping. Plus, it acts as a spin flip. And here it's important, actually. I reacted to spin flipping because it's important to flip spins in this problem. That's how these fields appear. So in this sense, it's hard for me to predict really what the effect of those things will be here. There definitely will be here, but
so one has to do some kind of Bogoliubov-Dejean.
Oh yeah, exactly. Yes. So what I'm saying, you know, the separation into fake gauge fields and spin flipper, it's essentially like a quasi-classical approximation to if it's smooth enough, you can do the separation. But in principle, you can just solve the type Bogoliubov-Degen type of equation for these systems.